I was asking if we're have our little section.
Yeah, so is there an order? Like, does ESRC ask first and then the public, or what?
We're done with our little spiel, okay. So yeah, what do you think?
So yeah, we'll be recording everything that's coming from the ESRC and any comments or questions that come back. So we're recording right now, so we'll go ahead and start with the ESRC with any questions from what we saw on the way up here and what's going on with the information that was just provided to us just now. So, or any other questions about the Habitat Conservation Plan that you
Okay, so thank
Lisa
you.
Lisa Hadway.
I appreciate being here in person because it's a lot better than seeing it on paper. As I recall, so we're at Turbine 1 and the numbers go higher as we go down. As I recall from past reports, there's specific turbines that tend to have more take of either birds and or bats. And I'm just wondering if you could point those out to us as we go, because sorry, I don't have that in my memory or on my phone right now. So it's just helpful for us to know, because I recall that from past reports, like there's a specific one that takes more bats than others.
We haven't found any huge spatial patterns, so that is in the HCP, and I can maybe grab that with kids later to pull up those figures. But there hasn't been, there's not like one specific, like really bad turbine. It's pretty spread out, because we look at both spatial and temporal patterns that we may see. And part of that is like low sample size. So we have in the cars for folks is where we tend to see Nene often and where we have found nests. We've been working with DOFA to try to get the population up here banded, but we haven't been able to yet. So ideally we would be able to kind of track the population and know whether when we have a fatality, is it the Nene that are living here or is it a Nene that's transiting through? And unfortunately we just can't answer that without having them banded. And DOFA is the ones with the permits to do that.
Yeah. And at the second stop, we're going to talk more about the Nene nesting because that's a really good example.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
There are areas of the project that have a higher concentration of that peely grass too.
Yeah.
I'm sure that attracts them in by the numbers.
We see the Nene more down by where we'll stop at Turbine 15 for sure, is where more of the nests and stuff have been. I don't, like up here, I don't know that Nene are. Juan and Miguel, if you ever see
Nene
up here, but
it's rare, maybe from the operations building.
Yeah.
Because of the grasses, we see them there often. So turbines 8, 7, 8, 9 might see a little more traffic. KWP2 as well.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Jason Omick, ESRC. So I'm looking around this pad and I see no vegetation right here on the side where there possibly could be some bees living in there. But everything looks pretty clean around here. I don't understand why there has to be vegetation management up in, you know, are you guys searching above these areas?
No.
In the okay.
No. So yeah, our vegetation management ends at the edge of the pad. So we are not like spraying or doing anything. My understanding, and unfortunately I'm meeting with Maui Cultural Lands on Sunday, so I haven't been up here with them yet, but some of those have been outplanted by Maui Cultural Lands, as well as the project, I believe, back after construction.
And Jason, we'll see down lower some examples of pads where there is vegetation growing up, and we'll talk about that.
Okay, because, you know, when we were talking about the 23 acres and along the sides of the roads and the pads, to me it seems like that can be really shrunk down or almost completely avoided over time until surveys are done, and then we can come back and look at areas where we see the bees are here. This is a place to absolutely avoid. But I'm just kind of going down that path in my mind of where maybe this species may not have to be on a permit because we can completely avoid.
And on Turbine 15, we have a great example of that. Okay. The bees are there. We know they're there, and we can show you kind of what that limit of disturbance
would be. That would be great.
Yeah, really good example. Yeah.
But Miguel can also potentially, and I don't want to put you on the spot, Miguel, but like speak to, in a normal year, we're on the roads and paths. We're not going off the roads and paths for typical operations.
Even when we have cranes, we work hard to avoid going outside the pad area. We'll set the rotor in a manner that the blades, as they extend out, they're not extending into vegetation.
Yeah. I assume it's the road grading. Sorry, Melissa Price, ESRC. So I assume it's the road grading that would have the most potential impact, because with a dirt road, you're having graded decently on it, I assume, having lived on a dirt road before. So I assume it's those kind of activities that if they're along, where's the guy? Everyone looks different now. Yeah. Oh, there we go. Okay, so if they're along the edges, that's when you would have the impact. So it would be frequency of road grading. What area is that impacting? That's where I would expect to see it. And as long as you've got the surveys happening before and after, then you know your take.
That's right. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's going to be a survey next year, so we'll know. We're all on board at that point. I think the general thinking is that, like, on the pads and the roads, which are impacted, and there's a, you know, there's even a cloth barrier under there for weed control stuff, that there'd probably be a lower potential for nesting, but on the edges, you're right. Like, when we get down there, we'll see, like, a normal operation, just in, you know, trucks and stuff like that, easy, but there's just some, like, some corners, right, where, like, you might end up in friction. And then when you add that up over 20 turbines and the road size, then you end up with potential for 23 acres. So that's where all that comes from, but you're exactly right. That's
Forgive me if I was, sorry, one second. But Jason Omick.
We know.
Okay,
we
know. You know my voice then. The road grading, what happens once or twice a year, maybe?
It really depends. We have a contract with Rojack where they're required to come up here monthly just to make sure the road is passable. If there is a rain event that just damages the road, we may have them come up more frequently. If we go 2 or 3 months without the need for them to come up, it's really more on an as needed basis.
Because I can see, like, compacting the road, but by pushing stuff off the side of the road into those edges where bees may be, you know, it looks like that's not happening that often from what I can see. It's more of like fixing the potholes in the middle.
Well, it could be monthly. I mean, having watched road grading before, you're pushing it onto the side, it's going to impact it.
Some of the grading that comes in from the sides of the road is just them trying to bring the gravel back that was driven by the eroding waters.
Okay.
And you know, I think it'll be interesting to see what the surveys show, because, you know, it's been here for 19 years, and the bees are, if they're using the fringes or edges like that, I mean, I think that's useful information for all of us, and then we can figure out how to kind of work our way through it. That's another interesting consideration about the project.
When they're going to be the proposed maintenance that's going to be occurring, and kind of what
the major maintenance
activities would that involve.
I'll talk about the timing, and then Molly or somebody can talk more about that. But yeah, so aside from the routine day to day, which we were just talking about, there is a plan. So, you know, this facility has been here for 19 and a half years or whatever. So if it's approved to be extended for another 20 years, they want to, they're going to come in and do what we just call major maintenance. So they're not changing anything, but they will, you know, take the turbines down in some cases and fix them with rotors and motors, and then reassemble them just as they are. And when that happens, and I'm going to get a little bit on the edge of my expertise here, that's when that happens, that's when it does require heavier equipment and machinery than just the regular O&M kind of day-to-day stuff. And that's where there's the potential for, like, to get big things up here, to move big things around. It might take a little bit more. And now I'm going to stop talking.
Start explaining what a normal repower looks like, where the entire turbine tower components are removed and a brand new turbine in its place. Here, the structure is staying as it is. We're just replacing some of the higher failure rate components to get the turbine to run another 20 years. So essentially, they'll be the same as you see it today, just cleaner.
It's the internal parts too, right, Miguel?
So think of you see the horizontal pieces on the very top? That's the nacelle. And that's where you've got all the major components. You've got the gearboxes, you got the generator itself, you know, various motors in there. That's what's being replaced for the next 20 years, basically. And, you know, once again, this project, it's a 30 megawatt wind farm, produces enough power for about 17,000 homes per year. So it's, while it's kind of a smaller wind farm, it does produce a lot of energy. It's a great, obviously, wind source, as you guys can see here. Wind is always blowing, it's always producing energy. For this, they will not need replacing.
They haven't replaced
it. Yeah, yeah. Not, so what can be done is they can get lowered down, and then any like refurbishment that's needed, they'll do it mostly on the ground. There are times when you can actually go and rappel and then do the blade work on the blades themselves, if I'm not mistaken, right?
That's correct. Yeah. We haven't had any catastrophic blade failures at this site. Knocking on wood.
Right.
But we do occasionally repair the blades. Most of the repairs can be done with technicians repelling on a rope down the blade and making the fiber repairs. If anything is significant enough that needs to bring the blade to the ground, we haven't had any of those as well, thank God. But yeah, the rotor can be brought down to the ground and the blades can be worked on safely here for larger, more structural damage.
And Miguel, remind me, but we had all the blades inspected. They're all looking good.
They're
at this
actively
point.
Inspected.
Yeah.
With drones and with personnel, and they're also actively repaired.
Yeah.
Can you remind me? So you mentioned the winds are always blowing. Can you remind me of the assumptions about? So you said you searched the bare area, mm-hmm. and I get that there's a trade-off between like not cutting back a bunch of native vegetation versus your search area. I get all of that.
Yep.
But can you remind me the assumptions about how, like, how many do you expect are getting knocked out of this search area versus what you expect to fall straight down for you to perfectly find it?
So it depends on the size. Yeah. So like a Nene carcass distribution is different than the Opeopea.
Yeah.
And at this site, that is based on, and I don't have the number of years that this was done, but we did these larger 200 meter by 200 meter plots. And when we drive down, you'll kind of see some stakes that are still in the vegetation that folks walked for multiple years. And so based on where those were found, I believe Nene is like 35% of the fatalities fall on the roads and paths, which basically means that for every one Nene we find, there's two more that we missed. And so then that's accounted for in our annual report to you. So the number that we are tied to is not the number we find, but it's the number that we statistically think is what is actually being killed.
So the assumption would be then, I mean, bats, I would assume, can get thrown a lot further than the Nene, and so it's a much larger adjustment.
Yeah, maybe it's bats that are 35%. There's an appendix on the DWP.
Just flip right to that page.
I wish. It's like I feel like I should know it that well. And
isn't it the last appendix?
I believe we added it at the very end. So that would make sense. Let's see here.
Yep, it is. Appendix I. And it's 70 meters search area, right, Molly?
It's the graded roads and paths within 70 meters.
Within the 70 meters. And it changes based on
each turbine is different. So bats, 57% fall within the road and pad. Seabirds are 24.6% and Nene are 35%. Okay. So it's actually the smaller ones are closer.
Is there a figure though that shows the search area?
Yes.
And that's in the packets that we have for the group.
Okay. Oh, do you have one readily available?
And while you're looking for that, those numbers were established pre-dog searches, correct?
The numbers were established by people searches, right?
Would have to double check exactly when dogs were added, because I feel like maybe they were used for part of that. Okay. But it might be people searches.
Okay. And it would be based on pretty small numbers, right?
Yeah, I think they used like, so Nene is probably based just on Nene. Seabirds would be not just the covered species, but other birds of similar size.
And the bats were based on other
small birds,
I would guess.
Which is standard for,
just based on the height and basic physics, standing under here, you're like, I kind of expect them to fall straight down. Like, I kind of expect them to get struggled pretty far. So pretty outside.
When I think what's unique about this wind farm is you all do use that site-specific data as
versus
opposed to
modeling it.
We had concerns about the whole Amir being out of date, that model, but your site specific data goes up to, you constantly are using the new data to
we base it just off the larger plot since now our data is truncated to 70 meters.
Yeah, you're not currently searching outside the pad, so there's no data.
No,
to base it.
So we no do data, yeah. Any carcass, like, the dog is really good, so he finds things off the rodent pad, and those all get recorded as incidental. Okay. But because we're not standardized searching out there, we can't, there's not a way to statistically account for those carcasses. Yeah. So we report them, and he does find some, but it's just not systematically searched.
Yeah. I mean, based on that, you can use basic, like, survey techniques for detection probabilities project out.
And it really depends on, like, the wind and stuff. Yeah. Like, if the wind's blowing then he detects something, like, really far down there. Versus on a calm day, it's actually harder for them.
That makes sense. Okay.
So, in the figure, whatever figure number that is, or... I don't know if that's in the HCP too.
It is.
Maybe for the record, you can figure out which figure that
figure
is.
Figure three.
So the purple circle, so the search area. I'm just confused. I thought you said you only search the pad, but then the search areas are bigger than the pad.
So we search within 70 meters on the graded roads and pads. So we're searching the bluish green area on figure three, and the purple is just showing what 70 meters is, but we aren't searching all the way out to 70 meters. We're only searching on the graded roads and pads within 70 meters. But so it's basically showing where on the access road we continue to search.
And the shape changes per the turbine.
Yeah, so we're here. We're at this turbine right now. So we search up a little bit up the Dofa road that goes past turbine one, and then we search down the access road we drove up until we get 70 meters from the turbine base.
And just for reference, the hub is 55 meters high. So 70 meters is another 15 meters. If you lower that tower, 70 meters would extend in all directions.
And that's what it's supposed to be.
So we're just searching
larger than the height of the tower.
I almost think it'd be easier if we just took the purple off.
Okay. I mean, it's helpful to understand, though, what your calculation is based on if you're thinking in terms of 70-meter radius, but you're only searching a subset of that.
Yeah, and we actually, but it's actually even more than 70 meters, because it's, I have to look up exactly what the plots were, but we do assume things fall further than 70 meters as well.
Yeah, just to echo Melissa's concern, like if something got hit, as the blade was going up and it got launched that way with these winds, it would go. So, how is that accounted for in the percentage?
35%.
Yeah. So, like for a Nene, we're assuming that 65% of them are being
launched.
I don't want to use the word thrown, but
found
are beyond where we're searching.
And again, that was based on work that was done a while ago where transects were being walked by people that extended it out further, and then those percentages were derived from. And I guess another thing I'll point out about that, that's somewhat unique to have a fall, that we call that a fall distribution, to have a fall distribution generated from data on a facility. There are other just like standardized fall distributions that we sometimes use on projects all over the country where you don't have that facility specific data, but you can see this is a pretty unique situation. So having that facility specific fall distribution is actually really helpful.
And we did look into this with Fish and Wildlife Service status difference. So we have been in consultation with those folks as to what is the most appropriate. And where we're at right now is that using the site-specific distribution is better than using a model.
Okay, so I rode up with Juan, and I asked some questions in the vehicle that, you know, you asked share that. So one of them is, I was asking about why is some of these off and some of them going, and I believe Juan said that the ones that are off are for maintenance, but the electric company has the power to run down or shut off. So that was something for the group. So I asked him, so when it's off, does it just free spin or not? He said off is off, right?
You won't see it spinning, but it is turning really slow.
Like this one here.
Yeah, so that's kind of my question. Why is this one kind of spinning and that one is not spinning?
This one we stopped because we're here for your safety.
Yeah.
That one is waiting for some components.
Oh, so that one's broken.
It's faulty.
Yeah. Okay.
This one we put in idle.
Idle.
But the, you know, as the energy grid works, like you generate energy, it goes into the grid, and HECO has the ability to say, okay, we need more or less energy at any point in time, so they can actually require curtailment to just reduce the energy generation because of what the grid needs at any point in time. So that's another type of curtailment.
HECO has to manage how much power they're able to take. Sometimes very late night, early mornings, the grid demand is around 100 megawatts. If we're 30, it's 30 plus percent of their demand at that time. If all three wind farms are running, it's not possible for them to take all the energy. Once solar starts ramping up, some of the people cannot control. There's less and less demand for wind power, and they won't curtail us or reduce the amount of power we can deliver. And that's how you arrive at the lower percentage things. Sometimes we just can't control how much of that energy HECO can take.
About how much is curtailed nowadays?
It depends. Phase two is first in line in the hierarchy for curtailment, so it will be the first to be curtailed.
Yep.
Once that is curtailed completely to zero, Oahe will be second. Once that is completely right down to zero, then this will be third. It really depends on the demand of the grid.
Just to ballpark, 50% of the
larger percentage of KWP2, over 50%.
Really?
Okay. Much lower up here.
Okay.
Physics or the mechanics behind why this one is spinning so slow and that one's spinning so fast.
The blade angles, when they're changed because they're in idle.
This one's off.
Yeah. Or
but even
stopped,
if it's off, why wouldn't it still? Is there something slowing it down in the mechanics up there? There's a break. Okay.
Depending on how it stopped, the blade angles may be at a perfect feathering position, or it's not seeing wind to pull the blades in any or lift the blades in any direction. This one may have a slightly higher blade angle, 83 versus 82, and that's just enough of a blade angle change to catch some of that lift on the blades. You'll see some that may be completely stopped, like turbine 10. We'll drive by in a minute. There are people inside that turbine, so they may actually lock the rotor for their own safety. That rotor will not turn at all.
Okay, so in their search, regardless of whether it's on or off, running or not?
Yeah, that's right.
So you said the yellow face B stuff, we'll see when we go down the hill.
Yeah,
so
we have a really good example. Yeah. I mean, it could be anywhere, but down there it's right near where there's high concentrations and we have some
flowering alima down there.
Yeah.
So the big site, though, where they're known to occur is where relative to where we're at?
That's where we're going next. Near where we're going next.
But you said that you guys haven't been allowed to survey on the pads yet, and there was another site nearby where there were a bunch. That's what I'm asking.
That's
about.
Off of Turbine 15.
Yeah, it's just...
Okay.
Yeah, we can walk up and look over the edge.
Okay.
We decided that we didn't want to take all these people down there.
Okay. So for Dofar, is there any... endangered plants up here that is a concern for you folks?
Not near this area. There is one plant that I think botanists are concerned about. It
snails.
Oh, sorry.
How about the snails?
Snails, no snails.
You used to have them further up the road.
Yeah, they're all not near any of the project area here.
Going back to native plants really quickly, we do have a CDUP condition to transplant any native species. So even though they're not protected, we do have an obligation to avoid and minimize impacts to native plants, regardless of their protection.
So this is Lisa. One of the questions I asked in the vehicle was the sanitizing of, or the source of the road material coming in, and whether that's a concern for weeds and or ants or other invasive insects.
I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know the answer to that either, but when we contract with Rojack, they're aware of the sensitivities, the need to wash the equipment before they come up, so as to not accidentally transplant any materials from previous jobs onto the site here. Where they get the material, the type of material, the untreated phase, they're aware of all that. So.
Yeah, because one of the things, like for Hawaii Island, transporting of ants is a particular concern, especially on Mauna Kea, but as fire ant populations move,
security protocols are, like, if they're bringing up material for grading like once a month, that's a pretty frequency is associated with introduction of new stuff, right? So do you happen to know what the biosecurity protocols are that they use for checking stuff?
Let me correct the material that's brought up here is not every month.
Okay.
On this trip we are having them bring up some more material, but it's not every time, maybe once, twice a year at most.
For the grading, grading material.
For the grading, okay. we do more material. Frequently, but okay. Bringing up material to bring up the levels on some of the areas that are more heavily affected. Yeah, that's not done every month.
I think we're going to have to look into the biosecurity and
we'll review our protocols.
And for a site visit, like, had we not seen those trucks coming in with the material, we may not have even asked that question. So
that's why we're here.
Yeah, so appreciate it seeing that, because that was a big, like,
Yeah.
It's a long ways up. There's nothing else that's going to introduce things up this high.
Oh, yeah. And I would have thought of a big truck full of
cars. So I had another question in that truck about the bat deterrents. So S1, he said there's one in every nacelle. Is that right?
We do not have bat deterrents here.
No. Oh.
I stand corrected.
Oahi.
Sorry,
Juan. We used to have acoustic detectors up in some of them.
Kevin make a hoopoo with the deterrent.
Is there a reason why you wouldn't be incorporating that in the new...
So we definitely talked about that. Our bat take rate hasn't been at a level where we have felt that was justified. So we're at about 1.7 bats per year across all 20 turbines. So that's total across all 20. So, you know, less than one bat per turbine. We've definitely looked into deterrents, and we're using them over at our Kahuku wind farm, where bat take has been more of an issue. I know Oahi has used them as well, with mixed results.
I was going to add on to that. So recently the agencies have been consulting USGS, and the stance, I think, of, I don't know if it's BAC Conservation International or a group, is basically like deterrents should be used for research purposes, but they can't guarantee, like, deterrence, essentially, like, avoidance of... So there's speculation, it's very site-specific and to be used with caution. Some sites, it's even potentially luring bats in to investigate, so...
So we're focusing more on curtailment.
And I think that was brought up by, like, Earth Justice, talking about curtailment and impacts.
So can you review the curtailment?
Yeah, sure. Our current curtailment is from sunset to sunrise, February 15th to December 15th. The turbines are feathered like this, so they're slowed down if wind speeds are below 5.5 meters per second. And that has been in place since FY 2015, I believe, was put in as an adaptive management measure after the first 7 bat fatalities, I believe. And did you see a reduction in the rate after that?
We, when you run the two data sets, like, so pre-curtailment and post-curtailment through EOA separately, the bat take is lower, but not statistically significantly lower. But it's like 7 before and 5 fatalities after.
Yeah.
So.
Tough to say.
It's It's a good problem to have with a threatened and endangered species to have a small sample size, but it makes it harder to speak with confidence about whether what you're doing is working.
5.5 is kind of low. I mean, 6.5 would do more. 6.9,
and we are
6,
looking.
6.9 is the absolute cutoff.
We are looking into that, and the acoustic data that Troy talked about were correlating that with the wind speed data that's collected at the top of the turbine to look at sort of what percentage of bat activity is happening at different wind speeds.
One thing many people wonder about is what's happening with the bat population over time. My name is Paul, but just recently I looked at the statistics from 2014 to 2017 for bat detection. You're just wondering, has that changed since then? Is it going up, going down, staying the same?
I know for a couple of years there was a significant increase in bat activity. I would need to check the most recent report as to whether it was still significant or whether it's just at an increase now and not a significant one.
Okay. The other thing that was surprising, not to be surprising, but very marked in the statistics was the bump in September, October.
Yes.
Way more than the other month.
So that's one of the things we're looking at is this idea of redistribution of curtailment. So like going up to a higher cut in speed in September and October and then dropping it at times of year when bats are less likely to be here. And that is something we're hoping to have in the final HP.
And then just wanted to ask specifically, are you looking at time of night? Because I know in the HCP it indicated exploration, but it didn't. It wasn't clear.
We're also looking at time of night related to sunset. So we tend to have the majority of our bat activity occurs within 5 hours of sunset. And we're working with the turbine manufacturer and Juan as to how complicated of a curtailment regime we can realistically implement versus like just having a single cut in speed for the entire night. Or having one for the first half of the night and a different one for the second half of the night. So those are the types of things we're looking at.
Can you remind me, is there cattle grazing in this area?
No.
Okay, so no cattle grazing.
There are access deer.
Of course.
I have
a question about that. What is your mitigation for the access deer for ungulates? Because if in the HCP you're looking at the habitat area for melee, right? I mean, it's not just for the melee, it's for the meacanu as well, for the plants, yeah? Deer like to whack all kind plants, and so what kind of mitigation do you have for that? Because I didn't see it.
We don't currently have anything. DOFA has recently, and they can speak more to this. My understanding is that DOFA recently put in some ungulate fencing, and they do targeted helicopter shoots here. I don't know
but
if anyone from DOFA.
Like, when you go and look for the other dead people, not you, and maybe see a deer, you guys just go, nah, DOFA, go get him. I mean, like, what do you, is there any kind of SOP for that?
Where DOFA shoots them is not close to the bats. We will shoot them down in the gulch. They'll
see the
carcass there, but
deer within the project area itself.
We see them cross from time to time, but if they see a car, they'll just run away.
And I would add a couple things there. One is the, you know, the project has an easement, which on state land, so there's easement. So there are the, limits to the ability of the project can be and certainly, I mean, I can't speak for DOFA, but I don't imagine they want Terraform shooting deer. So I think we're relying on DOFA to help keep the deer population.
Huge numbers of deer further down on the other side.
Did ask DOFA if there was a provision for some members of the public to come and take a carcass that would have been shot by DOFA, and we were told no. I also asked off the record if this area was open for the public to just come and shoot. After hours, of course, not while we're here. And they also said no. There really isn't much we can do while we're here. We have a no-gun policy on site, so we definitely don't want to encourage our employees to start bringing firearms to potentially introduce a risk that's undesirable for us.
Bow and arrow.
There's a lot of wildlife control happening across this whole island. The Maui issues more permits for hunting at night to control wildlife than any other island. So it's happening on a pretty grand scale.
So I'm wondering if we want to go to the next stop and continue some. Yeah. We have some of these similar conversations down there, but I think we can move down there and talk more about some of the site-specific stuff with bees and the limousine disturbance and stuff like that.
Is there anyone who has an interest in seeing either of the traps we have here? Only because this is where I happen to know two of them are.
There's one right behind us.
Okay, one of them's right over here.
If anyone has a hard stop that needs to be at the gate at a certain hour,
just Rob.
Let us know too so that we can make arrangements to have.
Rob does this.
I just want to walk the pad.
Okay, yeah. Why don't we... Yeah, let's just do a walk this way, and then we can stop by the live trap, and then the other trap is right when we get in the cars.